everyone, and welcome back to Phantom Galaxy. I'm your host, Nathan Bartleball, and tonight I'm joined by two co-hosts. We have Chris Durham with us. Chris?
How's it going, fellas?
And we have Jason Coupler, first time on the podcast. Jason, say hello.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me.
Okay, guys, and tonight we're going to talk about a couple different things. We're going to have a review for you for The Cure for Wellness, Gore Verbinski's new movie that came out just this past weekend, and kind of falls within the horror, sci-fi, dark fantasy. Kind of hard to categorize in some ways. It's going to be kind of hard to talk about, I think, without spoilers, but we will give you our mostly spoiler-free review.
Sort of Rubik's Cube of film.
Yeah, and then we want to kind of jump into talking about kind of hallucinogenic and surreal horror movies. Not necessarily just trippy, drugged-out movies, but movies that sort of, from a visual and atmospheric perspective, are mostly concerned with showing you something very different. Kind of a different mindset is the way I tend to think of them. Some of these movies might have to do with actually taking drugs, but I don't think that's necessarily a requirement for that.
Nor is taking them while listening to this.
No, that's very true. I haven't thought about podcasts you should listen to while stoned. I don't know. Is that?
Have we gotten to that level?
I don't know. We may reach that one day. Petition for the 420 podcast.
Oh, no.
So let's do a little bit of news. Chris, you got anything for us?
I saw something that was kind of cool. It takes me a little bit back to my childhood. I saw an article online where they're doing a Netflix show going to be released sometime this year for Castlevania as this animated cartoon series. Apparently the producer from Dread, the movie that was related to Judge Dredd.
The Carl Urban Dredd.
Yeah, Carl Urban is making this. And a few quotes of his were that it would be super violent, whatever that means, and flip the vampire subgenre on its head. I think we've seen enough of the flipping of the vampire subgenre around lately, but
flipping it on its head so it throws up all over the place.
Pretty much. I think this is kind of cool because video games have always been very, like, cool, cartoony sort of things.
Which, for those who don't know, was like a Nintendo game initially, game back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And was kind of fun. It was kind of a mashup. You fought Dracula, but you also fought like Frankenstein's monster and the Wolfman. The attempt that felt like Castlevania to me was like Van Helsing, even though that movie was horrible and kind of wretched.
Well, I
thought it was horrible and wretched, but it'd be interesting to see it done as a series. Like, it's all that gothic pomp and circumstance kind of thing.
I guess, yeah, time will really tell, but it does also involve, apparently, Dracula and the Belmont clan, as usual. So we'll see how that pans out. I think it could be interesting. If you go online now and you type in Castlevania on Google, you'll see like they have a poster artwork up for it already.
Yeah, kind of of the castle, which looks kind of cool. It's going to be weird, though, because I think in a video game it works, but it's going to be weird to see someone try to fight Dracula with a whip. Like, that's just that's going to be a little odd. So interesting. Netflix has really been like burning it up lately, though, with interesting shows and acquiring things. We were talking earlier about I'm the Pretty Thing That Lives in the House, and tomorrow they've got one coming out. Is it I Don't Feel Safe in the World Anymore or something like that? Like these nice long titles. And it's actually Macon Blair, the writer of Green Room and the writer of Blue Ruin. It's his directorial debut. It has Melanie Lynskey and Elijah Wood in it. It looks pretty crazy. So I think it comes out, it's tomorrow the 24th, so I think tomorrow it debuts. So I'm very interested to see that. And they've got a lot of decent content. I know they acquire some and they make some. Of course, Stranger Things blew up last year, and the OA was interesting. So I'm willing to give, I think Castlevania at least be, it's animated.
That's going to be interesting. I don't know how that's
because I know they put a lot of animated content out there. My kids really like Trollhunters, which Guillermo del Toro did, and is Anton Yelchin actually did the voice for it. And that was kind of, I mean, that's fun. So it'll be interesting to see whether it's just kind of bad anime kind of.
What kind of style are they going to go with it?
Is it CGI? Is it hand-drawn type?
Right, because I know they throw a lot of animated stuff on there. I'm not necessarily a fan of all of that.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see. They have a new Voltron. I don't know. As a kid, I liked Voltron. It was cool, right?
Yeah.
What's better than robot lions that turn into one giant robot, right? But
I had a kid upstairs who borrowed my Voltron, and he like broke it apart and broke off the wings, and I was really pissed.
Here's your Voltron. Try to reassemble it. It will now transformed it into a pile of rubble. So also, we have Alien Covenant. They just released a sort of like, how did they pitch this?
They described it as a prologue. It was called The Last Supper.
But it's essentially kind of a get-to-know-the-characters sort of piece.
For a few minutes.
Yes. Yeah, and we just watched that. So what did you guys think about that? Again, it's not very long. It's not going to show you any kind of alien carnage. It's literally trying to give you, I think, a feel for the crew prior to setting up
the movie. And actually, I think kind of in a good way, they were. I feel like they took some deleted scenes, like scenes they had to cut for length or something almost, and made this thing out of it. But I think that was good because what we got was some pretty decent intro to the characters. You got to flesh out a little bit more. You got a little better feel for them. So the rest of the movie has that kind of level of character development or involvement. I think it could be good. We'll see. I liked what I saw.
Yeah, I guess some things are notable. We see Michael Fassbender as David, but a different David than the one that was in Prometheus.
Possibly slightly more advanced.
Yes.
Yeah, he seems like it's almost the difference between Ash and Alien and the difference between Bishop. Even though that's played by Lance Henriksen, it's two different actors there. But the difference between those two androids, even though David was, to be fair, seemingly he in some ways was more nuanced than either Bishop or Ash in the Alien movies. Even though I think that clearly the movie took place before those two movies. Danny McBride. As weird as he Danny McBride and see James Franco there. Yeah. And I was like, when is Seth Rogen going to walk out or Jonah Hill?
He's probably in an alien suit hiding down one of the corridors.
And he's a little, like, Danny McBride's a little bit, like,
he's a little goofy.
He's also a little more reserved.
Danny McBride
he's talking
character.
About, I'm going to colonize all over this table or something. But
he's not Eastbound.
But he's not over the top with
he's
it.
Not quite, like, he's not.
What's interesting, too, is James Franco did not want to party.
He it looked like someone laced his weed.
Maybe they did. He was very tired, and as soon as James Franco went to bed, they all, oh yeah, let's party, which is kind of the opposite.
And
of
Catherine Waterston was in there, who's in Inherent Vice. That's the recently Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. Mm. So I think she'll be interesting. I'm curious to see if Noomi Rapace, who was in the first film, is going to play any kind of role in this. I heard that she's in the film, but it's going to be an aside. I mean, what are they going to do with the ending of Prometheus? Because Prometheus, to me, was that big build-up to a big kind of like mind-bending science fiction movie, and now we're back to a movie where essentially aliens run around a ship and eat people. Which I'm not opposed to, per se, but it seems like that's not what Ridley Scott wanted to
make. All
of
us nerds really want to see them go to the engineer planet and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I just don't think the promise of Prometheus is going to be,
And I don't know if it was just David's look, new David's look, but it seemed just throughout that prologue, like he knew something that the others did not once again. That's what I got out of it. Like, he just kept looking at him, just weird little glances by Fassbender. I don't know if he's trying to be, if it's a robot thing, but he's a good actor, so I'm thinking maybe he knows something that the crew does not, which would be interesting.
In line with all the rest of the series.
That becomes a thing. It's like Fassbender is very, there's an element, though they play it back and forth, of malevolence to him in Prometheus. He does some things that are clearly not cool. But there are also things that a detached non-human might do for the sake of scientific curiosity. Not that he necessarily has a malevolence. Although there is a lot of play up in Prometheus between the way that they treat him less than human, and he is aware of that. I guess these are minor spoilers for the movies if you've never seen them, but like we see Ash, and we don't know really like much about him. We don't not trust him until we know not to trust him, so to speak. And then, of course, when Lance Henriksen comes on screen, we instantly don't trust him because of what Ash did.
Yes.
And so it's going to be a question of, are they going to play that on its head? And I think that they probably will. We'll probably get a David that is maybe more concerned with the crew. You know, we might get the Bishop version of David versus the Ash version, if you will.
And in Aliens with Lance Henriksen, I still remember the scene of him crawling through the pipe with his head way too up close. That always weirded me out. He just had his receding hairline, his giant head toward the camera. It might have been the scariest part of the movie for me. But I'm not particularly.
There is a creepiness to that, to the whole thing. So yeah. I'm interested to see it. I am a little, I guess now at this point, originally we were going to get Alien Covenant, and at the same time we were going to get the movie, the South African director who did
Neil Blomkamp was going to do
the Alien sequel with Sigourney Weaver, and that's apparently like dead now.
It was going
along, and I think the last I've heard is that it's very unlikely it's going to happen. And I would imagine you're going to keep, it's going to probably depend on what happens to Alien Covenant, but I don't know what you want to see happen, so to speak. Like, if Alien Covenant is a hit, will we see another movie in that same franchise vein? Who's going to want to go and bankroll a movie with Sigourney Weaver in a sequel to these other movies? that want to ignore some of the movies when you don't have if Alien Covenant does well. So I feel like if Alien Covenant does well, they're going to want to keep building that franchise.
Oh, yeah.
It's a shame that Neil killed off not only my brain cells with Chappie, but also his possible making of Alien 5.
Yeah, I'm sure Chappie probably had something to do with that. Oh, he like,
I like Chappie's voice. I will get that. It's
well, yeah, an
interesting,
I mean,
voice for a robot.
And of course that actor who was the same guy who was in District 9, and also Elysium, though, was like Elysium, his follow up movie. I think everyone was excited for it, and it didn't do anything for me. Like Elysium, I was just sort of like, oh wow, that was a big come down from District 9. And then for Chappie to be so much in the same vein, where I, you know, it almost looks like that kind of one hit wonder sort of thing. I mean, I hate to say that, but like, I think that's maybe where everything started to fall apart. It also didn't help you're making another movie that originally is going to be Prometheus 2, and then they decide, oh no, let's straight up call it Alien. So once they
he could have
that,
a Shyamalan like trajectory. He could be make a good couple of movies.
Oh yeah, I don't argue that. I wouldn't be surprised to see this Alien. But the thing is, we're at a point now. Sigourney Weaver, like, how many more years is she going to have that? Like, she's going to play the action star of an Alien film. I mean, even so, she's probably not going to be.
I mean,
the
who would
star.
Believe that even now? You know?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and I just remember a lot of I loved Prometheus, and I know we had some you guys liked it as well, but. I just remember a lot of people complaining, there's no aliens, there's, you know, it's not Alien, which is a little strange. It was kind of a movie in itself, so maybe that's why.
There was
the thing is, I don't know who was going into Prometheus saying, gee, you know what I need? I need some aliens. Everyone, that, to my understanding, was going to see that to see something different in
that
same
universe.
It was
almost too much Alien for me, actually. I wanted it to be further from Alien than it was.
Yeah, I agree. I just remember when I would look on IMDb or anything else, people were like, where's the aliens? I thought this was an Alien sequel and blah, 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 blah. But it's a whole different
This
kind
is
of
why
movie.
The message boards at IMDb have officially been disabled.
Yes, that's true.
The wretched hive of scum and villainy. Yes. It must have been like, we have too much negativity on the internet to balance out negativity that seems to be coming from up on high. We're going to just destroy the IMDb message boards to restore the balance. Because I went on the other day, I was like, Jen was like, what did they think? What about the ending of this movie? She's like, I can tell you where you'll get the craziest ideas. And I'm like, wait, there's no more IMDb message board.
That's
what happened
true.
To it?
It did help me understand the end of The Wailing a little bit better, though. I really like that with that because I love that film. And it's very confused after my first viewing. So, well, yeah.
But yeah, speaking of confused, I think I don't know that we have anything else.
Oh, there's one thing I like to say. If you don't mind. I was really a huge Stephen King fan, and with Hulu and J.J. Abrams kind of coming
just
Castle
this weekend,
Rock, which I read a little bit about it, and I guess it loosely ties into the King universe and ties these stories together, which could be...
So it's like an anthology, which is
going
to be cool.
It's kind of an anthology, and I guess, you know, maybe it'll end with Needful Things and, you know, all that, but it could go really good or really, really bad. And I'm excited about it. I hope it makes sense. It's not like, oh, here's Cujo running it, you know, Pennywise. That doesn't make sense.
Well, it reminds me when they did the movie Cat's Eye and, like, Cujo chases the cat underneath Christine. Like, all this kind of, like, really on the nose.
Movies. I
like, to be fair, I like Cat's Eye, but that beginning is almost too cheeky.
It really is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't even mind if they retconned Needful Things, because I'm not a huge, like, that was his final Castle Rock story, but it just wasn't a very compelling, and it was such a, it was almost Dickensian, and the, like, oh, here's the devil and his, like, shop of and the movie version is really not very good at all.
No.
I mean, it has a lot of good actors, Ed Harris and Max von Sydow, who's, like, kind of performed the trick where through Needful Things he's managed to play the devil, Jesus, and an exorcist all throughout his career. Like, and he played chess with the death.
All sides of the
seal, he's kind of covered everything because he was in Jesus of Nazareth, I think, or the greatest story ever told. One of those two films.
Who wasn't in the greatest story ever told?
That's a very good point.
Let's be fair.
I think, that's a good point.
I think Hollywood threw every actor it had at that.
That was a biblical epic. It's like, we'll just have everyone come through. I remember one movie had like drunk Rod Stewart. I was like, wait, what? He's like a drunk priest or something. It wasn't one of the higher end movies, but I'm interested to see what they do. Because I thought that the other King adaptation Hulu did was pretty good.
Oh, yes.
And which was 11/22/63. Yeah.
Yes.
And Franco was in that one too. He was good, James Franco. Hulu is definitely, they're trying to build their group of shows and things that they have on there, yeah, because they don't, they can't quite compete. You know, Amazon has had a lot of good stuff lately, Man in the High Castle, mm-hmm, and they recently had Z on there, the Zelda Fitzgerald story. Mm-hmm. And of course Netflix has a lot of really good genre stuff. I kind of enjoyed, Hulu did one a while back, booth at the back of like a diner, and Xander Berkeley was a guy, and people would come and talk to him and kind of share stories with him. It had an anthology approach, but you never knew who he was. He kind of clearly felt to be some kind of supernatural character that was outside of time and space, but you were never sure who exactly he was. So people would come and confess to him, and he would give them an ultimatum at the end. And eventually someone would come to him, and he began to confess to them. So it was a weird sort of back and forth.
That's very
interesting. But it kind of got, I think it got canceled. But I could see an approach like that being something that would be interesting for, like, Castle Rock. You know, if Castle Rock has a tying together element, that it's not just a bunch of random stories, like a day in the life of, you know, so-and-so at Castle Rock. Mm-hmm. So I hope that it's more than just a gimmick, mm-hmm, to appeal to King lovers. But mm-hmm, I think that it might be, you know, if particularly if King himself's involved. And that I'm unclear of at this point, how much he would be involved with it.
I don't know. I know he endorsed it and said he's excited, but I don't know if he's excited to see it or excited to be a part of it.
Yeah, yeah. He endorsed Thinner at one point.
Under the Dome, though, as well. I love the book Under the Dome and the show not so much.
The first episode was good, and it went completely downhill from there.
Yeah, I stopped after the first season. So Stephen King and cinema.
Like I say, he had a cameo in Thinner, so that should tell you something right there.
Oh, I didn't even know he was in Thinner.
Thinner was pretty. It was pretty bad.
His best cameo, of course, was in Creepshow.
His best cameo is in Sons of Anarchy. I love him. He's Bachman. He just takes care of bodies.
Yeah, yeah.
And they just have him chop up the one victim and kind of put him away.
Which was kind of cool, too, because Bachman was his back in the day.
Right.
Very, very cool.
So, on to our kind of, I guess, review, the only review we're going to do tonight, a full-blown review for The Cure for Wellness, which is Gore Verbinski's new movie, and Verbinski's done a whole lot of stuff, like, over the years.
All over the place.
I remember the first probably big movie, I don't know if it was his first movie, was the movie that, his first big Hollywood movie was Mouse Hunt back in 97. And I remember this primarily because I think I remember my family going to see Titanic and it was sold out. So they're like, what else is playing? Mouse Hunt. which is a darker, weirder movie than you'd expect. Like, it's more of a Roald Dahl-esque dark comedy than it is just a straight-up kids movie, Mouse Hunt. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's really that. He displayed there, he had some, like, weirdness. And then he did The Mexican, which was also, in its own way, a strange kind of a movie. It had a kind of interesting performance from James Gandolfini, like, playing this hitman character. That was the movie with Julia Roberts and Brad Pitt. It was another movie where you walk in thinking, oh, I kind of see what this movie's going to be, and it was kind of off the wall.
I mean, that really shows you the range of Gandolfini, too. He's never done anything quite like that before.
A hitman with a fetish for dresses. So there was definitely a scene where Julia Roberts was exchanging panties with him. So yeah, it was a little different than you've seen from Gandolfini.
To be fair, I haven't seen it. I just assumed you meant he was your standard.
Gangster
guy.
That was the turn on the head. That's what I mean. Verbinski has never really done a movie that goes exactly as you'd expect. I mean,
I've learned something tonight.
He did The Ring, the 2002 remake of The Ring, which I think as far as American remakes of Japanese films go, was pretty good.
I think it's the best one they've done so far.
Yeah, I mean, I like it as much in its own way as I like the Japanese version. The Japanese version.
Have you seen the Korean version?
Yes. It's different, isn't it?
They call it The Ring Virus.
The Ring, but yeah. None of the follow-ups were that interesting. I think part of the thing is, even in 99, and then definitely 2002, you're pushing the VHS tape thing, you know?
Yeah.
So to keep going, it's on a VHS, no! It gets a little bit much, but Ring was an interesting, again, it was a movie that was a little bit beyond what you would expect. He played a lot with visuals in that movie, mm-hmm, where there was a lot of kind of very surrealistic, he had a lot of fun with the videotape, but even outside the videotape, scenes of like horses jumping off the sides of ferries and stuff like that. Yes. Of course, he did Pirates
Beautiful
of the First.
Beautiful landscapes. He was like,
he did the first three Pirates of the Caribbean, which they lost the storyline after a while, but you can't argue that those movies didn't have interesting visuals with the Davy Jones with the tentacle face and the ship on the back of crabs.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even to the third movie, he was still giving you stuff you wouldn't expect. Mm-hmm. That was probably to the detriment. People were like, where's this fun adventure movie with Johnny Depp? We got all this weird crap and
dark
Chinese pirates.
World,
and very strange stuff. He did The Weatherman with Nicolas Cage, which was a weird, quirky, mm-hmm, kind of a movie.
Is that the one? I think on the cover he has a bow and arrow.
Yeah, he walks through the street with a bow and arrow. People with their milkshakes out. Shit. I don't think that it was particularly good. Sometimes the movies that Verbinski does, I'll tell you what I did love is Rango. I thought Rango was very good. The animated film, Johnny Depp is a like chameleon, and he ends up in the middle of an animated like
it's a western. Metaphor for his acting skills, Nathan.
No, but this was a really good movie. It was weirdly, it's an animated kids version of Chinatown, if that's to be believed. I mean, but it is. There's a lot of cool stuff going on in that movie. And then he did
there's
the loan.
A corrupt water department.
Yeah. That's literally the plot. They're running out of water, and Ned Beatty is this evil tortoise that has kind of robbed them of the water through this complex plan. There's a lot of stuff going on there. Clint Eastwood shows up as the Spirit of the West inside a golf cart sitting on the edge of the... So it's weird and trippy too in its own way. And there's a lot of neat stuff going on in Rango. And then he did The Lone Ranger, which I thought was a bust. But again, it's not for lack of him trying.
Mm-hmm.
So then we get The Cure for Wellness, which is kind of a return to horror in a way. And the trailers are... It's the kind of movie from a trailer perspective that catches my eye because there's so many weird things happening.
I was sold immediately on the trailer.
Yeah, you don't get a handle on the story at all.
You're just looking at these insane visuals.
The scene with the train kind of going past the mountain.
It's literally arcing. You're watching the side of the train, and it's coming around a corner, going into a tunnel, and you can see the reflections of the lake
it's
and
beautiful.
The trees. Yeah, in itself a shot that you just love to see on an IMAX screen.
Oh, yeah.
And just look at that for a few minutes. And you're right, like, that was the shot that I'm like, wow, that's it. There's a shot where you're seeing the reflection of people talking at a desk through the eye of a stuffed deer or something on the wall.
Yes.
Like, there's a scene where that could just be two people talking.
Yes.
And yet there's a lot of really neat visuals that seem to be happening.
It's turned into something else completely.
Yeah, so every shot of this movie looks like beautiful and gorgeous. And the question, of course, is this going to come together as a narrative? Or is it just going to be kind of movie that I thought, hey, that was fun to look at? Because honestly, like, Dane DeHaan's in the movie. Jason Isaacs is in the movie. Mm-hmm. There's some other actors that you'd recognize. But this is not a movie you're going to for the actors.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that many people even went to it, honestly. It opened last weekend, and it really kind of bombed. Though I'm not surprised, though, because it's definitely... It has a very European feel to it.
I think
even from the trailer.
Run time turns people away.
Oh, it's
146
minutes of movie, and which is, I think, a lot. And particularly when you're trying to do something that's a little more ambitious.
Very ambitious. Yeah.
So... Yes. I think I walked into this movie knowing very little about it, except that you've got a character who finds his way to a Swedish spa in the mountains, and it's very different from the one that was in the Harvey Keitel, Michael Caine movie Youth that came out last year.
It was another
in the mountains kind of movie. I liked Youth, but like this is a much more sinister sort of of spa, and there's images of eels, you have creepy shots of... Everything looks suspicious, but then you have... Looks like cults coming around corners and walking through stone castles, and there's all this gothic imagery.
I thought it took place in Hogwarts.
They basically... there's
up in this castle, it looks beautiful like Hogwarts, you're like, what is
there's
going
not
on?
A single gothic shot that you kind of don't get in that trailer, and it did was sure. a kind of a callback to The Ring in the way which was, there's a lot of different disconnected visuals. So, that's all of us walking into the movie. Now, at the point Jason and I saw it a couple weeks before it released, and Chris, you saw it this past weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I guess we can kind of talk it. This is going to be a spoiler-free review.
Mm-hmm. Which, for this movie, is going to be really hard.
I think interesting. So, I think the basic setup... do any of you guys want to take a stab at trying to describe the basic setup of the film?
Okay.
Go for it. You're already into it. Go for it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're the guest.
Yes, thank you. The young lawyer or the young businessman played, and I forget the actor's name. That's nice. I'm glad. Yes, baby, Leonardo DiCaprio. He's tasked with finding the head of this corporation that kind of went away on this retreat and will not come back. And there's some other things, some shady business dealings that they want him to deal with.
They're going to get this guy to be the scapegoat.
Yeah, the scapegoat, essentially.
I guess that's not really much of a spoiler.
And basically, if he fails, he knows he's going to be the one who's going to be the scapegoat for the corporation.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a lot of shady capitalistics type stuff going on. And he gets there, and then just things do not go well. And it does, I guess that's really all I can say. I don't know how much more I can even say about that without these type of movies, leaving is difficult.
Yeah, exactly. Like, leaving is difficult.
That's really what I would say about that.
Right, because when you get there and you realize things are this messed up, even with that kind of caveat, you can't come back without this guy, he realizes pretty quickly, nah, can't be doing this. And it, you know, I think it's more like we can talk about the setting and I think the visuals, but you're right, like there's a point where the story, but when he gets out there, it's such a different atmosphere from the cold, antiseptic, like, boardrooms that you see in the beginning of the movie. Yes. Yeah.
You know what? I didn't even think about
it. So bright, colorful.
And it's like, like you said, that image of the train, those are all on the way to the, to this resort, to this spa. And as he gets there, and of course you're getting images right up front that are questionable about what's going on, and you get strange images that you know are going to come back later. You see the people, like, they're here at a spa, but they almost seem more like they're patients, you know, like patients of a mental hospital. Right. And I think the movie that for me, and Jason, you and I are talking about when the movie ended, it has a very, and this isn't just because of baby Leonardo DiCaprio, it has a very Shutter Island kind of feel.
Yes,
like, if
it
you
does.
Think about
Yeah, it does. The comparisons are easy.
Going really easy in there. Yeah. And I think, ultimately they're both going on a story bent that you know right up front. This movie's going to play with what's real or not real and what's right and not right. And there's going to be an underlying arcane structure to the movie. And I think the difference between the two is how they deal with that storyline. Because I don't know that either one is that surprising when you get to the end. I was not surprised by the plots of either film. I'm not going to talk a degree about the plots of either film. But you could tell there was a big, heavy reliance on style in both movies. Where Shutter Island was going back to almost like Val Lewton movies from the 40s and old like horror thrillers. Like Scorsese would even do wipes from scene to scene.
Yes.
But like here, Verbinski seems like he's almost channeling more like Italian horror or
it
weirder psychedelic kind of stuff.
Strong Italian sensibilities to it. Yeah.
So we kind of discussed that. Basically, you get this mystery going in, and you're going to have a lot of crazy visuals. So let's go around and just talk about really bottom line. Recommend it, not recommend it. What did you like? What didn't you like?
I mean, for me, the strongest thing, of course, were the visuals. I went into this thing thinking I was going to see a lot of amazing visuals, and you did. Just crazy, nutty stuff. That was enough for me to say that I liked it, but not something that I really recommend to people because the rest of the movie didn't really wasn't very cohesive to me, and I know that I'm more of a visuals kind of guy. So some people probably be looking for a more intricate story, a little more depth to it than what you really got at the end of the day. I just thought it was kind of neat to look at, but there wasn't a whole lot there.
What did you think about the runtime specifically, like the pacing of the movie too?
I felt like they really could have cut it down. Honestly, if you had given another director the same amount of time and the same premise, I think you would have really worked hard at making it much more twisty in terms of the story, rather than just like what the heck is going on the screen now. Like they would have really put together a big, bold, crazy, twisted story to match that like 2.5 hours, so you're constantly thinking what is going on.
And this movie wants to keep pulling things on you and surprising you, but
ultimately,
and I think without spoiling
bland.
Things, yeah.
Yeah,
were you that surprised?
Not at all.
From the story itself?
Like, honestly, right away, I was like, kind of got the basic gist of what was going to happen. And it really didn't deviate for me. I kind of, you know, when the big reveals happened, I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. I think this is a movie that you're going to watch and you're going to enjoy the ride more than the destination, because the destination isn't that great, but the ride was pretty sweet.
Yeah, I can see that. Jason, what'd you think?
I think this is a movie of two halves. The first about hour, maybe hour and 15 minutes, absolutely loved it. And there's even a scene in there, I'm not going to give any spoilers, dealing with the sauna, that's one of the scarier scenes I've seen in movies in a while, just when you deal with kind of claustrophobia and stuff like that. And like you guys said, the visuals are cool. Sorry, that's nice grammar there. And you see like the people kind of giving them a side eye, the neat little camera angles, the twists, the turns, but then I feel like the plot just, like, the main character makes dumb choices.
And continues to make
dumb choices.
Even for a horror film,
yes,
dumb choices.
Yes,
like,
mind you, yes. Mind
fabulously
you,
stupid choices.
Yeah, and it's it just gets in, and I remember talking to Nathan at the end, and I even felt like toward the end of the movie, it felt almost like it went from a trippy, weird horror movie to Pirates of the Caribbean. You even had the soundtrack kind of...
It did sort of change,
up, and there's battle sequences and just it's a lot of silliness at the end. But like, and I remember leaving the theater, and one of your critic friends is out there, and he goes, he just has his notepad, and he goes, that'd have been a good movie with about 40 minutes chopped off. And yeah. I think that that would have been, if Gore Verbinski would have
restrained himself a little bit
on just the creepy, weird atmosphere of this really messed up place with these messed up people. And the doctor, especially at the beginning, is very, very disturbing. And he gets less disturbing as it goes on.
Yeah, that bothered
me. And it just, and the reveal, I will say, I kind of got where it was going, but there is a reveal toward the end. It's just like, it's too just out there for no reason, other than kind of shock value, I thought. So it's like, I'd give, like, you know, if I was going to grade it, the first half would be like an A, and like the second half would be like kind of a D. So I'd put it in the middle at like maybe a C.
Like a C plus or something. Yeah, maybe.
A C plus, maybe. I really like the beginning, and then it's kind of just, you know, fell off the tracks a little bit.
Yeah, I'm pretty much in keeping with both you guys in the sense of going in, visual experience-wise, it's great. And there are some really just beautiful shots. Yeah. Like, I had said this about a movie I think I saw last month called Monster Call. See, there's no real similarity between the two, except that was J.A. Bayona, who also did The Orphanage. Ooh. Except that... this movie with the Monster Calls, I remember sitting there watching and thinking, man, there are shots of this movie that I would love to just freeze frame and make a poster out of. Like, I could see this being a beautiful piece of, like, fantasy art or something like that. Ooh. And there are scenes like this. When they are driving up to the chateau or whatever for the very first time in Cure for Wellness, and you've got the sun kind of coming through the clouds and breaking on the little the villages nearby. Like, that's just a great shot. Like, that's just... evocative as when you have Jonathan Harker coming into Castle Dracula for the first time in, like, really any of the Dracula films. 31 yes. Dracula, the Bram Stoker's Dracula, Coppola film. Like, it's just a beautiful, sinister kind of a shot. Absolutely. And, like, there are shots all through there. The scene that you're referencing with the sauna, when he goes in the sauna for the first time, and it kind of plays with the perspective of how you get turned around in a place sometimes.
Yeah.
And... we talk about that hallucinogenic kind of atmosphere. That was a very creepy scene.
That terrified me.
And there are scenes... Right. The problem is he doesn't sustain terror. This isn't really a horror film to me.
No. Very little.
But it has a horror plot, but it doesn't ever become horrific. It gets sinister at times. It almost... It eventually kind of just dovetails. After about the first hour, it heads into what I would consider more like a dark fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Or absolutely. I'd like to say science fiction, but it's so strange that you don't ever quite understand the science, so you're like, I don't know what any of this means.
Dark fairy tale.
And it
tale
never world. Really goes away. But after, it starts to repeat itself after about an hour and a half. Like,
yeah.
Where, like, this movie ends about six different times. Like, it has about potentially six different endings, but then by the end, it's like almost like the Scarlet Pimpernel or something. I mean, there are sword fights.
Well, when they have
sword fights, explosions.
Yes,
there
when,
are, like,
when it finally comes out on Blu-ray, it'll be like a choose-your-own-adventure version.
You really are. That's not a bad comparison. But what happens there, here's what I think is happening, is that they have all these beautiful visuals. They have a kind of story on paper that's like, hey, that's clever. But Verbinski's much like that train headed for the tunnel. It's like, eventually, at some point, you're going to smash up against the wall of the plot. Like, there's going to be a point where you can't coast on all these things you're doing anymore unless you're like... Dario Argento. And you just keep going.
That's all you got.
Which, when watching this, I thought a lot. Chris, you and I watched Inferno for the first time recently. I'm sure we'll talk about it when we talk hallucinogenic movies. Argento just doesn't care at some point about any plot. He just keeps throwing garbage at the screen.
This will freak him out.
He definitely gets a point where he doesn't care. We're going to play as much crazy goblin as we can, you know, crazy German music. And then we get some Rammstein or something in the middle of Cure for Wellness.
Yeah.
So the movie just kind of keeps going and gets nuttier and nuttier. I think, again, it's one of those movies that if you're someone who likes the visuals, who likes that kind of European-style horror movie, there are whole scenes in there you're going to want to see. It's an interesting movie. I was encouraged that, A, it's an original movie, like it's an original story, to
finally,
an extent.
Something out of Hollywood that's not a remake or a reboot.
Yes.
Right, and again, the thing with Gore Verbinski that I enjoy about him, he does try to be ambitious. There are ambitious scenes here. I could sit there. Even Lone Ranger, the last 20 minutes of Lone Ranger, I was like, hey, this is a great... fun movie. I mean, Grant, there was 2 hours that preceded that 20 minutes. And that's kind of, I feel here, I feel like you could assemble about an hour of really good stuff. But character-wise, I'm not drawn in by any of these characters. There's a point where these characters are not likable or interesting, and the visuals are interesting, but again...
I didn't find the main character interesting at all the whole movie.
No.
The doctor I liked. I did like Jason Isaacs. I think I liked
him because of Jason Isaacs.
I'd say he has charisma in the movie.
Yeah, and I know... Chris, I know you weren't a huge fan of the OA, but the OA, there's a comparable element to the doctors he plays in both of those films. or both of those series. And I think his character in the OA was more interesting. The character itself was more interesting than the doctor portrayed in Cure for Wellness.
Well, it's because Cure for... I can't say anything because I don't know the spoilers, but I'll just say that in the OA, you could somewhat understand his extreme method.
Well, I think that's the point. There's developing why things are happening.
Yeah, this is
in the Cure for Wellness, everything happens for selfish, personal reasons.
Yes. Yeah.
The other thing with the Cure for Wellness is it goes. It's one of those movies where it goes too far one way, but then ends up really being not enough. Like, a strange, surrealistic, hallucinogenic movie would have run for about 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It would have explained a lot less. It would have probably cut out almost all of the backstory involving why he's mm-hmm. there to begin yeah. with.
Yes.
It would have cut out a lot of the foreshadowing that happened.
Which would have been a better movie, in yeah. my opinion, honestly.
It would have almost been. Most of the scenes were probably praising. It would have been a lot more incongruous for your average viewer. Initially, but mm-hmm. I think that would have given them something to go back to and rewatch and see, and it would
yeah.
have, there would have been a basic story to hang it on. But when it introduces as much story, but doesn't put much care into its characters and doesn't put a lot of care into how that story makes any sense,
mm-hmm.
that's where it loses it. So it ends up being a too much, not enough kind of, to me, equation.
Yeah.
I was reminded of movies that are better. You know, I thought of Shutter Island, I thought of The Game with Michael Douglas, mm-hmm. a movie I really liked. And movies of that ilk that I thought were stronger movies overall. But I'm not sad I saw it. It had some really cool scenes. Oh, it had some neat stuff.
It's a nice experience in the theater.
There was some creepy stuff with eels.
Oh, yes. The eels are very good.
But there were scenes in this movie that almost outside of just the storyline. Yeah. Like, there's a scene where someone cuts open a cow at one point, and all its, like, eels and things fall out of its insides. Do you remember that?
I don't even remember that.
But to me, those are these images like that stick in my mind.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And I remember years ago, Roger Ebert reviewing, I don't remember what film he was reviewing.
Cows and eels.
Yeah, but reviewing a film and kind of pointing out that the things that caught him were the images. And you go back to like Expressionists and stuff like that. Their movies were made up of a series of images that left an impression with you, which is terribly the strength of this movie. But mm-hmm. it doesn't go the full route of the crazy, full-bore Italian horror movies. That's where much more nonsensical.
Yes.
So ultimately, I agree with both of you. It's not a movie I can fully recommend. I think a horror fan will get something out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're going to be hard pressed not to, but you're going to walk away from being like, that was ridiculous. I mean, it was ridiculous. Yeah. It was a ridiculous movie.
I'm not going to spoil this one scene, but there's a scene about halfway through that includes some cringe inducing, almost like torture porn esque. One scene in particular, I think, you know, you were cringing during it.
People in the theater were just like, oh, what was going on?
But no point to it whatsoever. Even the shot right after that
makes almost no sense. No yeah, sense. Like so, narratively, you're like, wait, I must have missed like 20 minutes
like
of the movie.
Someone saw a cut and said, let's add something grotesque for a horror.
You know what we need? We need more Marathon Man in this movie.
Yeah, it's just like I'm all for some blood and guts in the movie if it's done well. And this was just that.
I mean, technically. The actual event is done well, but you're absolutely
yes,
right
yes.
in that there's no thought in how it ties into
yes,
the rest
it
of the
looks
movie.
Yep. It's cringy, but
it's horrible.
Yes, it's just, it's not an eyeball, so I could watch it, but other than that, it's...
Yeah, it's not like was the Unin Chandelou, the slice going across the calf eye, but it's
yes.
on that level. Honestly, an hour and a half of that random imagery, it looks like an image that someone would have thrown into the Ring video.
Absolutely,
back, yeah.
I was going to go with the eyeball exploding from Slugs, but hey,
Slugs, a very fine film. I probably enjoyed Slugs more.
Slugs.
So I don't know. To me, kind of a wavy hand, like
yeah.
you know, it's C+.
It's
whatever
something
you
want
system.
Experience if you're
two and
a
half
fan,
stars, 6 out of 10, whatever you want to call it.
Just halfway in between.
Yeah, but bad right in the middle. Yeah. And given your mileage for the sort of movie, you may like it more. You may like it less.
So, I think, and maybe it's the director too. I hate to say that because I do like, but maybe he kind of just
he doesn't
that was a. A David Cronenberg or I'm trying to think of who else I thought Cronenberg might have done great with it.
Lynch, I mean, there's
Lynch,
a lot of different
Lynch would have made it crazy.
Lynch would no one would understand what was going on, but Well, no, it did some.
Well, I think there you've got that. The one thing about Verbinski, he goes outside the box, but he still doesn't quite overcome it enough. With some movies, does like with Rango, I thought he brought an interesting vision, but they touted him as a visionary filmmaker, and I thought, no, that's not right, because he's not really. He doesn't quite bring his vision all the way in. Cronenberg, Lynch, they have very specific
Aronofsky,
really good. Alex Proyas, who's Dark City, Dark City was the not every Proyas movie is great, but Dark City was clearly like the effort of someone who had a very clear vision.
Yes.
They wanted to bring to the screen.
Yeah, specific.
So that's what this one was lacking, was this clear kind of vision. So now that being said, what I want to spend the rest of our time discussing is what we were trying to kind of define hallucinogenic or kind of surrealistic horror movies. Now that's a pretty wide breadth of movies, because really horror movies in general tend to be very stylized, every horror movie. So stylistic, over the top, kind of altered elements are pretty much an aspect of most horror movies, but we're talking about those horror movies that go kind of above and beyond to like flip you out, to really give you the alternate experience, I think, where you would want to say you can almost not describe this movie as anything other than it's hallucinogenic, it's a wild ride, it's trippy. Quote unquote trippy.
Trippy.
And it's funny because I don't think that, you know, lots of times people talk about trippy movies. We were discussing how like the lists, you find lists of trippy horror movies, and sometimes it's just a movie where people do drugs. I'm like, it's not enough for your character to do drugs and have a vision. I mean,
was
your movie.
At this and Shrooms came up multiple
times. Yeah.
Shrooms is on Netflix, and Nathan said it absolutely sucks. So,
but I'd like to, if you're someone out there who likes Shrooms, let me know. But it's an Irish kind of slasher
Shrooms
movie.
Likes the...
Like the film Shrooms. I don't really need to hear from you if you like Shrooms. Cool if you do, but, you know, not necessary. So we could really probably start from the top and work back. Trippiest horror movie you think you've seen, or at least what comes to the top of your mind. I mean, we don't sift too far.
Recently, I'll say Inferno,
the Argento movie.
Yes, that one was just pure nutty.
And a couple of sentences. Why? What made that movie so nutty for you?
It was all over the place with the things it was trying to do. It brings in new elements of the story all over the place. None of them really ever connect. And there's this bright, brilliant color scheme they have. It's just like all these different colors and all the different shots.
Very lurid and candy. It looks like candy almost. Like the colors kind are that of kinda like saturated.
Yes. Very saturated is an excellent word. and all the elements, like little things that would go on, they introduce a new character and they would die within 10 minutes. And they just keep introducing new characters over and over, and different elements of the story, different parts of the building, different times and places. It's like just all this craziness mashed into this movie. So the whole experience overall
crazy
is more
synth music pounding through the entire film, which I think that's something else that adds, you know, even Cure for Wellness had the soundtrack almost just wasn't crazy enough, you know?
Yep.
Like every element, I think, of the hallucinatory film has to make it. It has to
Inferno
be there at every
definitely.
Level. Yeah. And Inferno was just like auditory crazy stuff that's happening. You're watching scenes that make no, like there's a scene where like rats just pour out of a storm drain and start eating a guy, and then some dude who's like chopping meat on the other side of the like river
in a hot dog shack
says to run over and let me chop this guy up while he's getting eaten by rats. You're like, what is happening? But here's the thing about a movie like Inferno. What's trippy about that movie, you know, that the general plot of that movie, it's a library research movie. They're looking for some ancient tome. They spend most of the movie in libraries looking around. And even while they're looking for books in the library, it's playing crazy synth music in the background. And Argento has these weird angles of like people running down library like shelves and crawling. There's a 15-minute scene of a guy crawling underneath like a vault somewhere, you know, down underneath the catacombs. Yeah. It's not even creepy. It's just he's crawling and crazy music's playing. And you're in a certain headspace. It's
absolutely
weird.
I think that is the key to talking about these hallucinogenic movies. You're in that headspace when you watch them. The movie takes you to that point.
Yeah. To me, a good hallucinatory movie should be the kind of movie that doesn't require you to do drugs, because it's doing the drugs for you.
Yes. Or the director did the drugs while making it. I mean,
but you know, it's funny, like Terry Gilliam, once I interviewed him, we did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. How many drugs did you do? He's I don't do drugs. I'd be afraid to do drugs.
I am looking at the list you guys have here, and all of these are the ones that I've seen are very, very good. A modern one, or more recent one, that I saw once I got my Shudder subscription was Kill List. And Killis is not really very hallucinatory until toward the end, and then it gets very, very out there.
Well, the whole thing had like a madness to it.
It did, but it just went off the walls. Yes. I loved it. I loved how it just changed. In terms of filmmaking, though, and you guys might not agree with this, it's not on here, but I still, Kubrick's The Shining, I still think the way it's shot, the way there's long tracking shots that follow this weird colored pattern, the way that there's just like this weird music focusing on Jack Nicholson's stares, he's not blinking. I think a lot of it looks as if people are going insane. And to me, that kind of aspect of the filmmaking there makes it a little hallucinatory. I don't know.
You know, I could see that. Agree
yeah. or not with yeah. that, but.
I agree specifically with like the particularly the Overlook Hotel, and yes. they have that great documentary Room 237. I think.
That's
great.
I've not seen that.
It's
you
neat.
Have to
it's,
if you like that movie, you have to see Room 237,
which is a movie basically where they just do all the crazy theories related to The Shining. But and not I don't buy into all of it, but some of it's just really fascinating when they talk about some of the shots, like how Kubrick brings you into a room and it's like, well, architecturally we should be able to see this, but we don't, and like
yeah.
he makes things off even without you realizing why they're
okay,
off.
Because I did have an odd feeling watching that movie.
Well, and it's funny because Stephen King writing the book wants to get across. I don't think it's a spoiler to say he's trying to get across the fact that the Overlook is an evil, not right place. Like it's not just that bad things have happened here; it's something wrong to the very roots of when this mm-hmm. place was built. And Kubrick, even though he kind of completely strays from King's story for the most part.
He does. Yes, he does.
He gets that across. Like, even when Danny is going down the hallways and stuff, even without take out the creepy girls, take out the girl in the bathtub and mm-hmm. all those kinds of elements, just going down the hallways, even when Jack Nicholson has the interview and yeah. sits down, look at the way Kubrick shoots the Overlook Hotel itself, mm-hmm. compared with the way they do it in, like, even the TV miniseries, where it's just, there's a scene of a guy talking to another guy. Kubrick is always, like, shooting it through with some kind of weird malevolence. Like, you feel like the place is evil. Yeah, like, yeah. something's wrong.
Here's another thing you ever notice now. I always thought Kubrick was a man who had a very clear eye for what he wanted on the screen. Very clear vision of what he wanted people to see.
Oh, yeah.
But in this movie, you watch it, and this is something they bring up in Room 237. I immediately watched The Shining afterwards because I was like, some of these things are nutty. I have to watch this. But they were talking about how, like, the whole place is so ghostly, like, just not partially there in reality and partially not. Like, you'll watch scenes and there'll be a chair here. They'll go back to that. It's gone. And to me, Kubrick's not the kind of guy who's just going to do something like that and miss. Oh, that chair was yeah. there. It's not there now. A lot of directors do that from time to time.
Not
he
him.
Was not that kind of guy.
No.
So when you see that in the same shot, like, three or four times, he's trying to tell you something about the very fabric of the building. Like,
yeah,
and things
not,
are there, but not there. Like,
not
which
right.
which ties in even when you get like into some of those very last scenes of the movie,
mm-hmm.
which it
oh,
reminds me, yeah, like the even the hedge maze. You know, it's
yeah.
this idea that time and King kind of references this. Yes, the Overlook is maybe haunted, but also it's kind of. Time and space are jacked up inside the Overlook,
mm-hmm.
which fits in perfectly with what you're saying. Like,
yeah.
yes, you go in this room, and that I shouldn't be able to see that.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe the house is messing with me, you
I
know?
See
so,
that,
yeah, yeah, and I really want to rewatch The Shining.
So
yeah.
right now, as we're talking
they
about it.
They just had it at the Senator last month. It's funny, because like the night they screened the Senator, they did the screening of Cure for Wellness. I realize now we should have probably just rewatched
maybe.
The Shining.
I just I was thinking back to the scene of when Danny Torrance is kind of driving the bike around.
Yes.
And yes, the little creepy girls come up and then they flash dead and then they flash back. And that's weird. But the thing that always got me is not only the pattern, but that it's there's no music. It's just a...
Yes.
Over and over.
Very deliberate
choice. And then it goes to carpet. And then it's... Carpet. And that pattern of weirdness going over and over again, it's just, that movie, Room 237, I've got to see that now.
You do.
Because
it's great.
I didn't realize some of that stuff in there. I just knew when I watched it, I was like, what is going on? And I read the book first. I love the book. I like the book even better. But I think that what he did with the movie really puts you in a strange mindset to make it very disturbing. Even the bartender, just the way he looks, freaks me out. Like,
yeah, there's just something off
something
and wrong.
Off. I don't know if it's makeup that they did to maybe highlight his eyes. Because remember, like a weird shadow, but not. It's just there's a lot of care to be weird in that movie, and that's yep. that's I gotta see that now, so I know exactly what yeah. went into it.
There's an interesting thing in The Shining where every scene, no matter how many characters are on screen at a time, you always feel they're isolated and alone. And yes. I think that's that scene you're talking about. There's nobody else in that bar. It is Jack Torrance yeah. and the guy who's possibly in his head. And they're sitting there having a conversation. Even later or earlier, depending on when you know which part you're talking about, when Scatman Crothers shows up and is talking to Danny,
yes.
you know, and he's explaining to him The Shining itself. That's not a warm, cozy scene of this guy explaining no. this yeah. kid's power to him. It has a weird, dark tinge
There's
to it.
There's a menace to that yeah, whole yeah. movie that's...
And I think that that does fit into the hallucinating, like hallucinatory in the sense that you don't feel like you're in like real time and space. And what you're seeing here could quite be just the dreams of somebody else. Yeah. And you mentioned Killis, that Ben Wheatley Killis. It was, it does kind of flip, but I think that Chris has this right from the beginning. What's weird about Killis is for the first 20, 30 minutes or so, you kind of feel like you're in a movie that is dealing with the real world.
Yes.
Like you're not even certain you're watching a horror film. And then slowly as it goes, things start to unravel and unravel to a point where you're like, if you came in the last 20, 30 minutes of Kill List, you would have assumed it was this kind of nutty, full-bore movie from the very go.
Yeah.
Which is kind of like, you know, the minute you're in Cure for Wellness, everything is, you're expecting something from mm-hmm. the minute. The Kill List, you're not really certain what's going on. But it builds and builds. It's never like a weird flip where you're like, how do we get here? But by the time you get there, it's like the crab being boiled in a pot. And by the time it's like, you slowly turn the temperature up until it's like boiled or steamed,
yeah,
you know?
Doesn't know.
Yeah. And by the time you get to the end of Kill List, you're like, how the crud did we get here with this happening? This crazy over the top thing, which isn't where the movie started. That was the movie, Jason, you were talking about. The violence really kind of bothered you in a sense.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And I don't know that it's because it's so much gorier than some of the other horror films we mentioned, but when you don't have a movie that feels like a horror film,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly you're watching graphic, gratuitous, really
that
like
is the movie I was talking about.
Messed up violence, it registers more than a movie where you see 50 people mowed
yeah.
down.
Yeah, it was weird because I remember everyone saying Green Room was really, really violent. I saw that and I think Kill List was above that. Now, is it really or is it what you're talking about where it's just more kind of normal at first and then all of a sudden you have some dude smashing someone's head off something until...
Which looks like you're really bashing a guy's head in. And that was... There are some yeah. scenes in Cure for Wellness where I'm like, dude, you're trying to get the most realistic version of this particular kind of violence. And I'm like, I don't know how I feel about that exactly.
Yeah.
So to me, hallucinogenic movies, particularly back, I think now, you know, you go to a theater and you see this movie and it's great to see it that way. But there's something to be said, to go back to that kind of Ring experience of the VHS movie, where mm-hmm. you're watching something that you got out of the bag. You had to dust the bin off and like you can nearly get like...
search for the crazy.
Exactly. You've almost gotten like black lung because so much dust has come up. And you're like wheezing. You should take out other people like, we didn't even know we had this VHS. Is this really a movie you can rent? You know, and you like rent it and take it home. And, you know, you open the box up and it, like, smells like old sardines or something. But VHSs and stuff like that are seeing a movie on, like, late night cable. You know, there's that adds to the weird sort of ambiance. I remember the first time I saw the movie Eraserhead, which we could almost mention any Lynch movie here. Lynch, again, has his own weird internal mindset. And the thing I think is fascinating about Lynch, he never has ever once tried to explain one of his movies.
Yeah.
He doesn't try to within the movie. He doesn't mm-hmm. try to without the movie. And I think there's something to be said about that. Sometimes his movies are too clever for their own good, I think. Mm-hmm. But some of them are great. But I remember first time I saw Eraserhead, I watched it at like the AV film thing at the community college I was going to or something at the time. And like I went in and sat down in like a little booth in the back of like the... You know, it was like 7 or 8 o'clock at night and turned this thing on. It's just me watching this thing with the big headphones on. That's a weird experience. And you're like,
yes.
This is wrong. Is someone with me? Like, mm-hmm. did someone just put this movie in here to screw with me? And that, to me, that whole ambience of, should I be watching this? Where did this come from? Did people make this? Like, you know, how did they get this in front of me? And there's a couple of movies that are like that. And that the really low budget ones, there's a movie called Eyes of Fire.
I was going to talk about when you're talking about getting black lung from trying to dig through the VHSs. That has that definite feel to it.
So this movie's on YouTube. So you guys can go watch this and then tell me how
it looks like they got it
up.
Straight off of VHS.
When I remember as a kid renting this movie my family renting it, and it Eyes of Fire. It's a weirdo. It's definitely like an indie kind of film. It has a French or Italian feel to it. It's done with American actors. Very, very low budget. It looks like it could almost be a PBS movie about like pilgrims.
Totally.
Except it's so messed up. It's like almost a companion piece to The Witch. Like, it's like you have these settlers who come in. They come to this colony, and they bring with them a woman who's been accused of witchcraft. And it's hard to really explain what goes on from there, but there's things involving evil tree spirits, there's demons, there's crazy little, like, evil face baby. It's a very bizarre film, and it almost has...
Mud
it people. Has a story, but it's a very distorted, weird story. And there's lots of weird, like...
At the end of it, it was really hard to tell you what exactly
you
just
You had
witnessed.
That weird, like, overexposed images and negative images and just... strange things happening, and stuff is just like occurring, and you're looking at it and you're like, I'm not quite sure what to make of this. People sat down, like, because of the nature of it, you're looking at it and you're thinking, how did this even come to be?
Yes.
Like, someone wrote a script for this. People practiced this, and then they filmed it and they made special effects.
Someone got paid.
Wow. I assume they got paid. And but I remember seeing as a kid and just remembering a specific scene where the girl who has the second sight or whatever is walking through this Native American village, and she looks over and she sees this little kid, but then it flashes and it's like an evil mud baby with like crazy cat eyes. And it just, if you look at Eyes of Fire and then pick up images on like Google, you'll see like the little crazy mud baby almost immediately. And I remember being freaked out by that and thinking this movie couldn't possibly be as trippy as I'm remembering it.
Yeah.
So we watched it last, what was it, St. Patrick's Day. And it's still pretty weird. You had never seen it before.
It is bizarre.
Yeah, you watch that coming off The Witch, and it's a strange movie. To me, those are the movies where it's trippy because the scenes just don't feel congruent sometimes. There's very haunting, lovely images, but you go from one scene to the next, and you're not sure how you got there, which cultivates... I feel like I fell asleep for 30 or 40 minutes at a time, but it's only a 90-minute movie.
Yeah.
So Eyes of Fire, it's YouTube. I'd recommend it if you just want to watch something weird and strange. And honestly, the copy of the film that's on YouTube is of a much higher quality than when I watched it on VHS. So
I was going to say, it looks like you got it off of VHS.
What I'm saying is you can watch it on YouTube. It's not like a really bad quality. You don't have tracking lines or anything through it. It's pretty, comparatively, it's probably as good a quality of that film as you're going to get.
Yeah, as you're going to get. Right.
There's a movie that's about 78 minutes long called Begotten. Have any of you seen this movie?
I have not.
Ilias Mirage, he did a movie that I really kind of like, but I don't think he did many after that. Shadow of the Vampire.
Ooh,
the movie about the making of Nosferatu.
Yeah.
That's the baby. There you are, Darky. I think I might make that our cover image for the podcast episode.
I have to watch this now. That kind of gave me a little bit of a vibe.
Creepy.
There.
Yeah. You got a little of a YouTube, your Eyes of Fire.
Eyes of Fire.
Don't go and look for an experience, not a... So, Begotten, I believe, is also on YouTube. It may be in chunks, and not the whole thing, I'm not sure. But he did Shadow of the Vampire. Did you ever see this? Amazing,
yeah,
of the movie Nosferatu with
Willem Dafoe.
Willem Dafoe played the vampire.
Wow, cool. I like that.
And John Malkovich was in it, too. That was a good movie. Begotten is much stranger. It's a very experimental film, which I think the plot is God kills himself, and then it guts himself or something, and sort of through this process... I don't know if it's God's widow at this point or something, but you have this female and her child who are now wandering this wasteland, and strange druidic figures are chasing them.
Huh.
And no one in this movie looks like a human. Like, there's creepy Jawa creatures, and there's a strange mutant.
So it takes place on the Phantasm planet.
You talk about Eraserhead. This is almost a direct sort of relationship to Eraserhead, and the images are so strange and disturbing at times it's strange, dark, gritty, black and white. That's one thing. Very kind of overexposed to the point where what you're looking at is just haunting. You're just not quite sure, and the story has a very mythic feel. Again, I mean, you start out with the character that you're assuming is God, and then this thing happens and that thing happens, and there's no context where you don't feel this is something happening in the kind of primordial ooze of mankind's consciousness. You know, it's not... You're not like, oh, there's a person and there's a person. It's just strange, creepy figures the whole thing through.
Ends. This is a myth of primal gore at the end.
Well, see, I used like most of those words, not in that order, but primal
God
gore.
God killing himself is a character in the film. That's his name. So this is another excellent...
Maybe it's just the post preacher world, like
it's not. But see, it's you don't even sit there and think about when is this happening because it's so far outside of time and space. It's like someone's telling you a fable where these things don't need to have a like we don't have to put a realistic space to them because it just doesn't exist. You're just watching something that is almost abstract at times. So to me, those are kind of the movies that stand out where they're. Like, the less you know about them, the weirder they are. Have you guys ever seen a movie called Possession?
I wanted to see this one, but I have not got around to it yet.
I think, maybe. That's
they had it at a film festival a while back.
I want to think of the actress. Maybe Isabella Gianni. I'm not sure. You'd have to probably look this one up. They played at the Charles a few years back. And this movie's strange. Sam Neill is in it. It's probably the strangest thing Sam Neill, hands down, has ever done. And it does involve, at one point, a woman.
He was the Antichrist at one point
in... This is weirder.
And in the Mouth of Madness.
In the Mouth of Madness. Both are strange movies. This is stranger. This is
a stranger thing
because,
than
that. Yeah, you have... We at some point, I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit about Antichrist, which was
Lars
von Trier's movie, where he kind of, you know, you've got this element of a haunted marriage, but then things just go. There are commentaries that are happening there that are just out of the blue. There's some weird stuff in Antichrist. There's some weird stuff in Possession. And at one point, you have this couple and this marriage, and things are going wrong. And then there's a point where the man she's married to, maybe he's not really her husband anymore, maybe, but then, you know, she seems to be having relations with the tentacle creature that may or may not also be wearing her husband's skin, and I think, you know, there's some creepy stuff going on in the subway, there's some tentacly.
And this is a full-length movie.
This is a full-length film.
It is not a Japanese film.
It is a very psychological, but there's a point when the psychological and the internal kind of just spill out into the movie, and you have very visceral, creepy, nasty stuff happening, but it seems to be the director is still trying to say something about relationships and the dark side of relationships, but you have tentacle monsters. So awesome. Possession, very weird. I'm not necessarily recommending this movie. I'm just saying that if you're talking about trippy, what did I just watch kind of movies, you got Possession. Very dark.
Well, the first review on IMDb says, like, nothing you have ever, in capital letters, seen before.
I think that's fair. I've never seen all of those elements in one movie
7.
Together.
7.4 out of 10 is not bad.
Not when you get to horror movies on IMDb. I remember I interviewed the guys who did the movie Spring. They did Spring and Resolution. And I remember them talking about, like, the IMDb curve is so different that, like, if you get 5.5 on IMDb, you're doing pretty good if you're a horror film.
Oh, yeah. That looks really interesting.
Any others that you guys are thinking of?
Yes, I was thinking one in particular that you had me watch one night. And I think Jen walked in on us. What we were watching is like, what the heck is going on?
I think I see Jen walked in on us like we were actually doing something.
No, this movie was weird. Well, yeah, okay. Let me rephrase. We're watching a very strange movie. But Jen walked in on the movie and said, what is this?
But that's, I think, the thing with some of these movies, talking about these hallucinogens, the weirder, more surrealist movies, you do get that feeling sometimes of people walking in and be like, you feel like you have to explain yourself.
Yeah.
I didn't know this was happening.
Insane. It's just like,
you see it too? I'm glad. Yeah.
Now, if you want to talk trippy, we're talking about a field in England. That is the base definition of trippy when you get down to that. Because
so you get back to Ben Wheatley at this point. Yes. And
I really want to see that because I loved Kill List, and Sightseers was pretty good for what it was.
This is far more experimental. This looks like he cooked, and I think he might have done it. I don't know what you could probably find this trivia out, but I think he must have filmed this thing in a handful of days. I think he had a bunch of guys, had them dress up like puritanical dudes, looking for a treasure in a field in England, and that's the plot. And then he's like, now they're going to do shrooms. And
I think he got his actors to do shrooms while he's...
Well, but the movie gets very trippy. I mean, this is black and white for the most part, but you have weird negative shots there, too, and strange. And you get that same kind of feeling that it eats some bad corn. Like, you're not really, like, certain. Like, you think, oh, this is the Salem witch trials. This is how that happened. They start to have those kinds of visions and signs of images, and the cinematography, at one point we're looking at cinematography, like Chris and I are like, we're not sure what we're looking at any point in time. We're like, oh, this could be the tortured dark canvas of another universe, or we're looking at somebody's poisoned genitalia, you know? Yeah. And then by the time you know, it's too late, you can't unsee it. So Field in England is an interesting movie, and you're dealing with these concepts of evil, good and evil, and like kind of cosmic, and there's a lot of like religious iconography, and mm-hmm. you're not sure, is this guy the devil, or is he just stoned? Yes. You're not really certain.
Just the message here is don't do drugs, kids. Come on.
There's not really a message. It's no, just, there's not. It's just weird.
But if anything puts you off shrooms, it should be this movie.
It had a lot in common with, I thought, with Altered States. Did you guys see Altered States with William Hurt?
That's one of those classics I have on my list to watch.
This is an interesting movie. He goes into the sensory deprivation tank. And in a lot of ways, it has that 70s science fiction movie feel where it's kind of dealing with cod science, you know, that kind of like over the top. But he basically goes into the regression tube. And if I were to describe the plot, it would almost sound like a bad 50s monster movie, like something along the lines of like Monster on Campus. I think of Monster on Campus, the professor ends up handling like a dead coelacanth or something into a prehistoric fish, and he turns into like a caveman and runs around for like an hour and a half terrorizing people. In this movie, William Hurt gets into the deprivation tank and turns into a caveman and runs around doing crazy things. But the movie is so much more surrealistic. That's not... Those movies have that basic plot similarity, but Monster on Campus is just a 50s, like, drive-in.
Don't forget the episode of Buffy where people were running around drinking poisoned beer and turned into cavemen.
Yeah, let's forget that episode. but in Altered States, there's so many commentaries that he's making on, like, on religion and psychology and things like that, and there are some strange scenes where he's just seeing like goats with six eyes and stuff like that, and the visions he's having while in the tank, the part where and the transformation scenes, these are transformation scenes that are done just on the heel or just before I think we get to The Exorcist. So his body kind of breaks down and then realigns itself, so there's horrible tortured scenes of him just becoming like human silly putty, and then so he doesn't just turn into an ape guy, like he gets big eyebrows, he basically, his molecules kind of pour apart and then pour back together into whatever form he has. So it's a very strange movie. It's dealing a lot with like psychosis and psychology. Mm-hmm. And he definitely goes out into the desert and does some peyote too. So you get some of that going on in the movie. But Altered States is a very strange, trippy film.
I saw that when I was in college, and I remember it being pretty good. I'm going to have to revisit that because...
So, yeah, I think it's interesting because you take a plot that on its face value maybe would be kind of more of a B movie.
Oh, it sounds stupid.
And, yeah, and yet you don't think of that plot while watching the movie because of what it's doing. Any others you guys want to mention? We have a couple more on this list that that I think are worth mentioning. We've mentioned some of, if you're talking Lynch, I think Blue Velvet's a good one that's very bizarre in terms of just bizarreness. I mean, people can decide whether for themselves or not they like it. I think for my money, Mulholland Drive is probably one of the Lynch movies where you have that strange surrealness that Lynch goes for mixed with a bit of a story that you can kind of grasp onto a little bit.
Is Mulholland Drive the one with the bum behind the dumpster?
Yes.
I don't know what to say other than that really, when I saw it the first time, I jump started at it, like they played like loud music in one of those jumps.
It kind of bothers you deeply too, because
no reason for it, no explanation. It looks like a nightmare, and
that perfectly describes Lynch right there. It's like there's no reason for it, there's no explanation, but it looks like a nightmare.
So here's another thing I think you could say about something about these movies we dub surreal, trippy, hallucinogenic. It's the fact that you show somebody something, and then that, did I just see that? Like, in a movie where we show, like, let's look here for one. We have the scene with the eels. We see eels about 70 more times in that movie.
Yes.
Which is all well and fine, but if we'd seen eels one time, and the movie cuts away and never mentions eels again, like, you'd be left with that weird, but you'd be left with this weird impression of the eels, like,
what the heck?
They wouldn't leave your mind. You get the eels mentioned so many times in Cure for Wellness, you finally get kind of tired of the eels. That dumpster scene you're talking about in Lynch, it's so typical of him because they kind of build up to it with a weird diner scene with the guy saying, hey, you know, there's a guy behind this dumpster, and once you see him, you can't let, you know. There's almost this feeling that for a few minutes, Lynch makes you think that the pivotal meaning in this movie is the dude behind the dumpster. But that's a completely throwaway scene. After he appears, they never go back to it at all. It is completely tangential to anything else that seemingly happens.
Maybe that
happens.
Is the only meaning of the movie, because, you know, with Lynch, no one ever really interprets his film.
But
the
I
way
think
that...
that's part of what you do with a film like this. You want to get somebody into a weird like headspace, a feeling of a dream where you see something, you go move on to it, and you kind of come back. You're left with these images that stay with you. But he builds a context. It's almost like he makes several mini-movies and stitches them together, like Lynch does.
Well, you talk about being in that kind of like weird, dreamy headspace, not knowing what you're watching. How Sue.
Yeah, that's the Japanese film whose like title is House. Have you seen this one?
No, I saw. I didn't even know how to pronounce it on there. So
yeah, is that House? So House.
I think that was great because that was one of our friends we made watch with us this film. I want to like,
let you.
The
I think I'm gonna let you borrow this one. I don't know if you're gonna be able to get your wife to see this with Jason, but it is a. So the Japanese. This is what happens in the late 77 or something. They basically say we want to make the. And I don't know how they get this point, but they say we need a movie like Jaws.
Oh,
and like, this is so but here's the thing. Crazy. They say we need a big like blockbuster movie like Jaws, and what they end up making, hire this guy to make what is kind of a weird Japanese haunted house movie that is so over the top, but I can't believe that Sam Raimi didn't see this before making The Evil Dead, because there's a piano that eats people.
There's some sort of inspiration there.
There's walls just vomiting forth viscera. There's a severed head that like flies around and bites somebody in the bum. A guy turns into a pack of bananas at one point. And there's weird scenes of just avant-garde stuff.
Yes!
It's hard to explain. There's a cat with laser eyes. Like a cat with laser eyes.
It is absurd. Yes. It is absolutely absurd.
And there's disco music playing almost constantly. Oh. Did you see some of the images there?
No, I just your description, I gotta look.
So this is, it's supposed to be
House,
like,
1977.
That's the one. And it is completely
bonkers.
Yeah, like, there's no rhyme or reason. You were watching this movie just to see where it's going to take you next. It's like a fun house.
So it's the opposite of David Lynch in a way, because David Lynch, when he does his stuff, there is a rhyme and reason to it, but no one will ever be able to determine what it is.
Yeah, I think with House Sue, it's the idea that we're just, like, you never get a feeling, and that's the freedom of the movie, I guess. This stuff doesn't connect.
Yeah.
Like, it just simply doesn't. Like, the laser cat, there's no reason for that cat.
But my thought, it blows my mind. The Japanese, who love the sea, and they want a big blockbuster like Jaws, and they come up with this.
Well, I think they were just thinking, we need a roller coaster ride. In general, this doesn't seem, at no point, if someone had said,
there's no blockbuster in this
anywhere.
Give
me your Spielberg blockbuster movie. Somebody handed me House of, you know, let's get this.
What you've been smoking? Yeah.
Pretty much. So this is a movie that's just, I kind of genuinely like it.
It is kind of crazy and great.
Yeah, yeah. I think that scene actually happens in the movie there. There's all those elements are in the ones. It doesn't make sense. But that's the charm of the movie. You're watching
it's
it.
It's an absurd
and
beauty.
It is. But, here's the thing. I was engrossed in the movie. I was legitimately into it. I mean, I don't. The characters, no sense. And as you see now, you had a black and white shot. You kind of need the full color experience. It's another movie. It looks like you're looking at candy. You know, like
essentially, that's a great one.
So if you haven't seen Haussu, it's Haussu. It's funny. It's a Criterion Collection.
I think that was the same day we watched Beast Pageant, which is also another
very strange movie. I don't think many people were aware of the Beast Pageant, but. You mentioned Angel Heart, Jason. You want to talk about that one for a few minutes?
I really, really...
This is an oldie, kind of going back,
It was maybe mid-80s, late-80s, and it has Mickey Rourke as a private investigator. I even forget who's trying to track down. I don't remember much of the actual plot other than some of the images. And
he's kind of chasing down De Niro, who's sort of like this
kind
of
Puff
Freeze kind of
him
character.
Something.
Is that right? Yes, yeah you're right. De Niro...
And he may or may not be the devil. He has these long fingers that just eat. There's scenes of De Niro with long fingernails just eating hard-boiled eggs while he's talking. And there's just a lot. Then you get into a lot of voodoo stuff in New Orleans. It switches from New York City to New Orleans. And the revelation, which I'm not going to spoil because it... Well, first of all, it's hard to explain. Second of all, I don't want to spoil it. It's just... It's out there. And it's... really good. So that's more along the lines of, I think that's almost a hallucinatory journey a little bit. I think you've seen it. Haven't you seen
it? I have seen it. And it's a good one to go in line with, I think, the Jacob's Ladder. We mentioned Jacob's Ladder with Tim Robbins, which is another movie that, like, you'd like to imagine that, like, Silent Hill sprung out of Jacob's Ladder a little bit. Like,
absolutely.
If you watch Jacob's Ladder. And Jacob's Ladder is interesting because it does double sort of, I think, as a drama about a man who's experiencing all this stuff. And it kind of starts to touch on these ideas of mental illness in a real way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just nuts. Mm-hmm. Like, it legitimately has little monsters and tentacle creatures at one point. And all of this weird imagery that you would associate with a full-blown horror film. Mm-hmm. And yet you kind of have this sad story about a guy who seems to be kind of just broken in pieces after coming back from the war.
The dancing scene in Jacob's Ladder where he's dancing with his wife and just that weird strobe lights and the music, and then you have these tentacles coming up, and just like that scene alone and the whole movie's kind of trippy and weird, but that scene alone, very off, and Tim Robbins, I think, does a really nice job of portraying someone who's just losing his mind. So I really like that movie a lot.
Do you remember that movie, The Final Wave, or I think it's called The Final Wave?
The Last Wave. Peter Weir's The Last Wave.
That crazy Australian, like, journey into, like, weird visions and madness.
That's a good one, too. It's in, have you seen The Last Wave, Jason?
No, no.
This is a good one to put on the list, too. It's another movie that kind of deals with a potential apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And there are, I'd say there are, we talked about Take Shelter, which is a more personal of journey into a potential apocalyptic, cataclysmic event. Mm-hmm. The Last Wave, it really deals with Aboriginal legend and myth. And, of course, a big myth of the Aboriginal people is Dreamtime, where you are kind of in this other world, this other reality, if you will, that doesn't follow the same rules, but kind of is a precursor to what happens in the real world. And there's some very strange imagery in that movie. There's some scenes where just creepy Aborigines are suddenly in the guy's house, just wandering around. But it also seems to...
Sounds like Thursday night.
A lot of the Aboriginal characters do come out prominently in the story, and it's a real-life backdrop. The story deals with, like, real things going on, but you start to have the fictional world bleeding into the waking world. Right. And it's a strange movie, but that's a good one to mention. I mean, that's a really... That definitely... When you start to meld reality...
And another one that I think we watched at the same time, but also just purely absurdly weird and kind of trippy, was Razorback, even though it should be a much more straightforward kind of movie.
Yeah, like, that was Russell Mulcahy, I think, who did Highlander and The Shadow and the movies like that.
Strange.
Kind of off the wall. Couple more here just to mention, I think. There's a crazy, crazy movie called The Visitor.
Yes.
A 70s movie that's just off the... It's just off the chain. It has a lot of actors. It has John Huston in it. Who began from Chinatown, who was the voice of, this is for probably the younger set, most people would know, he's the father of Angelica Huston, but he also did, he was the voice of Gandalf in the Rankin-Bass Hobbit movies. That's where a lot of people know him, I mentioned that. He's a great director in his own right, but he's in this movie, this is clearly later in his career, and it's just crazy, like, 70s tastic, like, pimp style music is like, and nice. The plot of that one is nuts. It's like, deal with, like, they tell the story about Jesus kind of being some astronaut or something,
and like the devil from space. Minutes.
They're gonna impregnate this girl with, like, the star seed of the devil or something. I mean, it's
birds insane. Are his, like, minions.
Lance Henriksen is in the movie trying to, like, bring all this to fruition.
It's madness.
You're not even sure who Huston is. He seems to be an interstellar traveler who kind of wants to recruit the girl. But you're not sure what's going to happen. And then every 5 minutes, like, dun-dun-dun-dun. And, like, you have scenes of just Huston walking through the streets with, like, crazy, like, Miami Vice-style music playing in the background.
That first 10 minutes where they try to explain the weird mythology of the movie is just insane.
It is. Because there's a lot of weird imagery that seems like it's coming from a bad Italian, like, biblical epic. But mixed in with these weird, like, horror movie. Other sense, a horror movie. Mm-hmm. That's just strange. We mentioned Lords of Salem a little bit when we were talking prior to this. Uh-huh. I wasn't really a fan of that movie personally. That's Rob Zombie going full tilt bonkers.
No. Roberto.
Roberto Zombie. Zombie. Yes. If you want to make it sound classier than it is, Roberto Zombie.
I'm a Rob Zombie fan. I've liked White Zombie, Rob Zombie music. And I like witch movies. I get that the phallic imagery in the last... little weird dream sequence is a bit much, and that's really the biggest hallucinatory part is the last 20 minutes.
It is. It's funny.
You really don't know what even is going on, but I would say that with, like, a lot of zombie movies, he gets, in my opinion, he gets a lot of it right, except for Halloween 2, but he gets a lot of it right, and then kind of goes off the walls. But the scenes with the three ladies, I remember talking, it's almost like a little bit of a Macbeth type thing. And they are, the three witches in the movie are really, really good. And yeah, the ending with the midgets and the phalluses and all that is a bit odd.
But I remember that
I recommend.
They sent me a screener for Lords of Salem, and I remember watching the first.
I paid to rent that thing.
I watched the first, and I think I might have been the reason you did. I watched the first 20 or 30 minutes of this movie, and I was like, wow, like. it's building like a normal story. You know, he's building an interesting yeah. horror story. You've got this idea of these records and stuff, and I'm like, it almost has a Carpenter-esque feel initially yeah. going on. And I watched all the first 30 minutes or whatever, and I remember recommending, I think, to you, Chris, and mm-hmm. Seth, and saying, hey, you know what? I think he might have done it. I think he might have made a good movie. And then then I went and watched the rest, and I was like, oh, I feel like I'd have sent people to their death by recommending this. Like, it's like the movie turns so completely. It just, again, there are, you know, there's that contingent. There's yeah. But if you really, I mean, it gets trippy, but there's a moment in the beginning where it's like he's building. He's doing the stuff that a normal, you know, he talks so much. You hear him talk. He sounds like a real film expert, mm-hmm. and he understands things. I mean, he's not, you know, but
he's no film schlub. I'll give him that.
The first 20 minutes is like, hey, all the things he learned watching all these horror movies, he's got that here. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, yeah, let's go nuts. And
well, to be fair, I mean, it's hard to resist the allure of being able to cast midgets in a horror movie. You're like, yeah. should I have midgets in my film? Yes, you yeah. should.
Oh, yeah.
They have 31. They've got one in there, too. The little Nazi Spanish-speaking guy. He's a...
There you go.
Our president?
Sorry. A few others to mention. There's a director we haven't talked about. He's only done about 3 movies, but I think his style is very interesting. Philip Ridley. Are you guys familiar with Philip Ridley at all? He did a movie a few years ago called Heartless.
I saw that.
Yeah. Which was really pretty good.
Yeah.
Guy has a heart-shaped birthmark on his face, mm-hmm. and he starts to have a lot of weird visions. It has a very Clive Barker-esque feel. He's seeing... Oh, cool. Basically, this is a movie I think has like reptilian dinosaur chavs in it.
Yes.
You know, there's these London punk kids who... similar to a movie that came out around the same time called Citadel, that was an Irish film where the demon punks, essentially. But Heartless plays with a lot more weird imagery, and there are sort of like urban demons that will... grant you wishes, and there are, you know, strange monsters hiding around corners, but it has a very strange hallucinatory feel. And he did 2 other movies with some interesting casting. He did a movie called The Reflecting Skin about a bunch of kids that accused girl of being a vampire, I think, or yep. a witch, and
a vampire.
Yeah. And Viggo Mortensen in that movie. And it is
weird little
strange, very strange American gothic kind of film.
Yeah.
And it is very bizarre. The Passion of Darkly Noon that has Brendan Fraser and Brendan Fraser and Ashley Judd in it. And it's yes. weird. And it almost
that
has like
bizarre.
Jodorowsky levels of strange.
Almost, yeah.
There's a little bit of Santa Sangre going on.
Hey, man,
on
we
there.
Got a giant shoe floating down the river at one point.
A funerary, a carnival funerary shoe or something, right? Like, it's a bizarre movie.
It says he wrote The Craze, which is not a horror movie, but.
And all 3 of these films in their own way, even Heartless. They're kind of dramas, psychological dramas. They aren't purely horror films.
Particularly
you
Darkly
and I would,
Noon. Right.
Yeah, but they have horror elements to them. And they definitely fall in that hallucinatory sort of vein. Mm-hmm. I think there's much of a horror movie, Santa Sangre, which is kind of a horror film, too. And we talked about that in one of our previous... Like, there's Tetsuo the Iron Man, which is a Japanese nutsoid Cronenberg.
Yes.
And if we're talking Cronenberg, you got Videodrome, which is just insanity.
Pure insanity.
And most of the things that Cronenberg has done, The Brood is a good horror film.
That's my favorite.
The thing I like about The Brood is it has, and we talked about The Fly last time when we did our like Valentine's Day horror films. Some of those movies. I think The Fly is a legitimate romantic tragic horror movie.
Well, very tragic.
Yeah,
yes.
And very gross. But like when you get to some of like Cronenberg's movies like The Brood and Videodrome, there's a story there, but there's a lot of other weird things going on.
I think if you want to talk crazy hallucinogenic almost imagery, definitely Freaks.
Also, to go back, the 20s Todd Browning film.
Yeah.
And Browning, of course, he does Dracula afterwards, but Freaks is a weirder movie than Dracula.
Yeah.
And it has some strange... Have you seen Freaks?
I have, actually. That's one of the
it's
only
bizarre,
30s
right?
movies
yeah.
that I've seen.
That scene where they're all crawling through the rain in the end. Yeah.
And they get him, like, and you know, I wonder if you'd be able to do that today as they did. The guy's just like, let's get actual Freaks and put them in here.
And it doesn't quite work, because even when you have the special effects now to do that without it, like, a good example, the American Horror Story, like, it just mm-hmm. comes off.
Yeah,
like,
that one was
it
cheesy.
Doesn't, there's some sensibility going on in Freaks that's very weird.
Freaks is
weird.
As much as the thing about Freaks, though, as much as it tries not to be exploitative, it also kind of does because it knows the audience is obsessed with it.
It does. I think the difference, though, between that and even something like American Horror Story is it really, it does kind of give a lot of humanity to the characters.
Yes.
I think that's maybe the difference. It makes it a little scarier because of that, too. Like,
I think my favorite sequence in the whole movie is we're all sitting down at the table and they're welcoming the like new couple.
Is that the Google like, Gobble?
Google Gobble, Google Gobble, one of us, one of us.
Yes.
Oh, that was great. God, that's right. There's another movie that's a little bit later than Freaks. Sorry for interrupting
fine.
Now. But I just remember it being really, really weird. And I don't know if it would count, but it kind of reminded me of Spider Baby. I don't know if
Spider Baby is not. Spider Baby's very crazy.
I love Spider Baby.
Have you seen Spider Baby? I
can't say as I've seen it.
Oh my God. I think it's great. My wife tried to watch it and she hated it. She said, "What is this? Fill in the expletive," and walked out. It does have, I can't remember the guy who played Captain Spaulding in the Rob Zombie movie.
Yeah. Sid Haig.
Sid Haig, yeah. It, very young. And
I love
just,
me some Sid Haig, I'll be honest.
This is a weird
really
movie. You,
good in it.
Yeah.
I think that you would like it, but it is, I don't know if you would think that's hallucinogenic or not.
It definitely is. It's a very bizarre
movie. It's very
kind of
bizarre,
movie.
And it's not really violent, but it's very disturbing. The implied violence
that's a
the
fair
end
point,
especially,
yeah.
is really, really grotesque. And it's almost the less you see, the better. So I would really recommend, that's one that I watched on YouTube years ago, like, oh, this is something stupid, and it's Halloween time, and I turned out to really, really like it. It was not, I thought it would be some crap, like, you know, I don't even know. I thought it'd be awful, and it wasn't. It was really, really good, so.
That's one of the nice things, some of these movies, you see it, and it does transcend what it's trying to do,
mm-hmm.
and you're just caught up in it. I'll mention just a couple more. Fritz Lang's M, which has a great performance by Peter Lorre, is a child killer, and it's, again, you talk about implied violence in a film. Sometimes you just hear the weird whistling that this character does, and then you see a lone balloon that obviously used to belong to a child floating through the city. So in some ways, that's even haunting and weirder. And a movie I have on the list is probably more science fiction. My all-time favorite, probably sort of hallucinatory movies, is Dark City, which has a reason for all of its weird imagery and builds to an interesting science fiction story. It has a lot of horrific kind of imagery, but that imagery in Dark City where you have these kind of rows and rows of people that almost look like they're a court of sorts, and they see their pale faces. These are images that are kind of right torn from M, which deals
with... Expressionist. Expressionist.
And the German Expressionism thing, Cabin of Dr. Caligari, is a very bizarre, very weird movie. Carnival of Souls, done later in the 60s, is a very bizarre, strange kind of movie that takes a storyline that's pretty, I would say trite, but you see where it's going and gives it a weird twist by just being so different in the way. Suicide Club, not a movie I really loved, but a weird Japanese movie.
That one was a lot stranger.
Opens with a scene of a bunch of like happy-go-lucky Japanese schoolgirls holding hands on the subway, right at the edge of the subway, right before jumping in front of it and just getting splattered upside the walls of the subway train.
Like
that means it's a film that has a skin belt at one point. They find a belt of like, each chunk is a different skin, clearly from a human being, and it's wrapped into a giant belt, and there's about 70 or 80 different pieces of it.
This is Suicide Club?
Suicide Club is the name of this movie, yeah. Not to be confused with Suicide Squad. It's a weird movie. It's a very, very strange.
Very weird.
It's weird enough that they weren't able to make an American remake of it that I'm aware of.
Really?
Yeah, so... the original Wicker Man has a very, has obviously very hallucinogenic, is weird.
And the remake, a fantastic film.
With Nicolas Cage in a bear suit kicking girls in the head.
That's pretty surreal.
That's very true.
The original had Christopher Lee presiding over orgies and weirdness
That's true.
So. You know, I have never seen the original Wicker Man, and as much as I like these weird movies, I think I have to check that out.
It's interesting.
I've only seen the Nicolas Cage crap
Nicolas Cage movie, you can miss the sequel, The Wicker Tree. That was pretty terrible.
Never heard of that.
Ingmar Bergman, aside from The Seventh Seal, had a couple of interesting pseudo kind of horror films. He did one called Hour of the Wolf, which was his attempt at kind of making a creepy haunted house story. That's very trippy and very surreal. Did one with David Carradine called The Serpent's Egg, which is also very weird. And he also did a movie that uses a lot of horror imagery, but ends up being, you know, kind of horror imagery, almost dark comedy. It also has Max von Sydow in it called The Magician, which is a pretty cool movie that I would recommend. Not one of his more well-known ones.
There's Anthony Hopkins, I can't remember. He plays a ventriloquist.
Magic.
Magic. With
a, that's a weird movie, that too. That I has also, a weird feel. Have you seen it?
I have not seen
it. So you have Anthony Hopkins and the ventriloquist dummy, and there's always the question of what's going on, yeah, and is the ventriloquist dummy getting into his head, or is he just going crazy?
It's, yeah.
So I think there's a lot of stuff here that you go on. We'd love to hear from any listeners about what movies you think constitute a good hallucinogenic creepy movie.
Mm-hmm.
I would say check out some of the ones we've mentioned. There are several that are on YouTube. A lot of them you can pick up other places.
Mm-hmm.
Last one I will throw out personally, and we'll let you guys have at it if you have any others. A movie not very well known, Finnish movie called Sauna, just one word. Mm-hmm. It deals with these soldiers coming back from war. It's a period piece. They come across a village that is sitting kind of out in the middle of this area. The villagers don't really seem to age. And there is a sauna, just a big kind of austere stone building out in the middle of a marsh. It almost seems like the whole village is sinking into the ground in some ways. And it's supposed to be, the myth is if you enter the sauna, it can absolve you of your sins. And these two soldiers are coming at it from two different perspectives. They both have things that they want absolution for. And as the movie continues, we kind of figure out what that is. We also start to learn what is actually in the sauna, what the sauna does. Now, by the end of the movie, when it's over, there's varying degrees of what the sauna does. So, but it's a neat movie, I think.
Yeah,
it's an interesting movie. There's a lot of interesting thoughts going on and a lot of very strange, mm-hmm. creepy, horrific imagery. So, guys, you have anything else?
I'd wrap up one last one, Under the Skin.
Remember the
one with Scarlett Johansson?
Which is also kind of like borderline science fiction.
It felt very
movie.
Felt very much like we were just talking about it with Room 237.
Kubrick, Shining 2001.
Kubrick. Felt very like Kubrick.
Maybe. Yeah, I think there was almost some 2001 elements. Have you seen Under the Skin?
No, I did read that a lot of the people she picked up were actual people. Like, and they had cameras filming the people. Like, they weren't actors. I haven't seen it. But
yeah,
she picks some people up and they're not.
She picks up a guy up at one point who has almost like a disease.
Man syndrome.
Yeah, it has almost like kind of that sort of disease and a similarity. But again, he's a real guy, real actor.
Mm.
That's not makeup you're looking at. And the film's very bizarre, though. I mean, it goes in a lot of weird directions. It's strange because the beginning of the movie is almost just Scarlett Johansson tooling around Glasgow picking up guys. And you're like, how? I mean, literally just picking up a car and talking to them.
Yeah, what is going on?
And you're
this?
Not quite certain what's going on, and yet there's some very sinister things going on. This is an interesting movie. There's another movie too, Hard to Be a God.
Oh,
hard to
I
watch.
Was
going to
mention that. Yeah, that
one is
crazy.
They're both
too.
Science fiction movies in a way, but you can almost watch them and not know they're science fiction movies. They're based off of very dense books, but they just kind of like The Shining. It adapts the mm-hmm. surface level, shows you what's happening, but doesn't really tell you why or how it's happening. And Under the Skin, if you go back and look at the book it's based off of, the book's nutty. Like, the science fiction stuff happening in the book, you're like,
mm-hmm.
what? Like, it's if
hard,
I were to sum it up.
Hard to Be a God, I don't think you'll ever find another film with more, like, snot and feces in
dude,
it.
Dude, it's one of the literally dirtiest movies. I mean, dirty meaning grimy, gritty,
yes.
gross. Control's another one. Do you remember Control?
Control, I remember.
The guys, it's guards working
it's
in an underground subway.
Dream,
that has another movie. And they're chasing a killer who may or may not be real. That's a good movie, too. Jason, you have anything else before we wrap up?
No, I actually think I interrupted with a couple things that just popped into my head as we went along. And
per the hallucinatory
trip. Yes.
So I think we've got a lot of stuff out there.
Very cool.
We will look forward to seeing you guys next time, and hopefully we'll have you guys back on the show soon. And everyone, have a good night. Take care.
Yes.
See you guys.
Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's cast, and we hope that you'll join us again when Phantom Galaxy returns with a brand new episode. If you wish to contact us, you can email us at phantomcasts@gmail.com. We're also available. You can find us on phantomgalaxy.podbean.com. And our episodes are also going up over at popcultureninja.podbean.com. All of the music in tonight's episode comes from Lithuanian artist Stellar Drone, whose ambient electronica creates soundscapes that are both haunting and fascinating to listen to. Stellar Drone's music is actually available for free on the internet in a couple of different places. You can find his Facebook page under Stellar Drone on Facebook, and you can also find all of his albums available on stellardrone.bandcamp.com. Until next time, this is Nathan Parawal with the Phantom Galaxy.